carry a fine of several billion dollars. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
The FBI is investigating a case of needles found in airplane sandwiches served on several Delta airline flights over the weekend. At least one passenger was hurt. The sandwiches were made in Amsterdam by the catering company Gate Gourmet. Cheaper gasoline kept down consumer prices in June in the United States. The Labor Department saying today so-called core prices that exclude the volatile energy and food categories rose 0.2% last month. U.S. stocks trading higher with the Dow up 57 points at 12,785. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org.
Support comes from the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center, hosting the 2012 Grassroots Radio Conference, July 26th to 29th in Urbana. The conference brings together media artists, organizers, radio operators, and citizens to learn, discuss, and brainstorm. More information and registration is at grassrootsradioconference.org.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. It's hour two of the show. The following program comes from the Focus Archives, which means for the next hour, we will not be taking your calls.
In this hour of focus, we are going to talk about disgust. There are a lot of interesting things about the emotion of disgust. It is a basic human emotion, and it is one that is unique to humans. But interestingly enough, it's something that we have to learn. People aren't born with disgust. We'll talk a little bit about what it is, where it came from, what its functions might be, and how it sometimes goes beyond what might have been its original function. And our guest for this program is Rachel Herz. She teaches at Brown University. She's an expert on the psychology of smell and emotion, and she is the author of a recently published book. The title is That's Disgusting. The subtitle is Unraveling the Mysteries of Repulsion. Norton is the publisher, and it's very interesting. So I think that people who are with us this morning will enjoy the conversation. However, I do want to have one word of caution here before we get going. It is possible that in the course of this conversation, you will hear something that's disgusting. So be warned. With that, we'll say good morning to our guest, Rachel Herz. Professor Herz, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you, David.
Being someone who is an expert on the psychology of scent has some downside because you end up being invited to smell disgusting things. And in fact, you were invited, I understand you were invited to be a judge at the National Rotten Sneakers Contest, and that perhaps led you into further inquiry into disgust.
That's absolutely right. So I wrote a book several years ago called The Scent of Desire, which is about the psychology of smell. And as a function of that book, I started getting calls from more of the outside world on smell-related things. And one of them was to be the judge for the National Rotten Sneakers Contest, which I found out is an event that's notable enough to be in the Farmer's Almanac. And it's held annually in Montpelier, Vermont. And kids from around the country who've already won their regional stink-offs come to Vermont.
Who knew?
I didn't. And another thing about this contest is that there's literally a hall of fumes where the winner's sneakers are enshrined. And anyhow, I was invited to be the celebrity judge in 2008 for the first time. And actually, I will admit now that I've done it every year since then. And when I was first invited, of course, I was a little bit skeptical, but the person who invited me was very insistent and very friendly and, said, well, you get to stay at a resort in Stowe. So that had some perk to it, too. And I agreed to do it. And in the interim, because there were about 2 months or so between agreeing and going, I would tell people what I was going to be doing. And the constant reaction was, oh, my God, that's so disgusting. Do you realize what you've gotten yourself into? And I started thinking about it. And I thought, well, maybe I haven't realized what I got myself into. And I started thinking a lot about what my experience at the contest was going to be like. And a couple of really interesting things happened. One, when I actually went to smell the sneakers, I'm not saying it was good by any means, but it was not nearly as bad as I imagined it could have been. And that made me think about how disgust is such a psychological perception and how we can change it by anticipation, by expectation, all sorts of, those sorts of things started to get interesting to me. And I started wondering about, maybe this is a reasonably interesting topic to pursue for a next book, and that's the beginning of how it happened.
Well, this in you know, discussing this with colleagues, I ran down some of the basic points, and I think that maybe one of the first things that people said when I said, well, you know, one of the interesting things about disgust is that only humans experience it, and they said, really? Is that true, that this is that emotional disgust, it's the only one of these basic emotions that is unique to humans?
As far as we know. So, I mean, it's not the case that every animal has been tested. And an animal that I'm actually interested in seeing whether or not they could experience emotional disgust are elephants, for various reasons, which we could go into more later. But apart from, it doesn't seem as though they do for now, anyway. It hasn't really been tested rigorously. But no animal apart from us experiences emotional disgust, which is different from spitting out food which tastes bad and is rotted. So many, many animals will reject food that is bitter or rotted as a function of its taste sensation. It tastes bad, it'll be rejected. And that's an innate reaction that we have from birth, as well as many, many other animals have. But the emotional state of, for example, how do you feel if I said, could you please hold your neighbor's dirty dentures, is an entirely different situation. And that is something which seems to be an emotional construct that is unique to humans. And the other thing about it is it has to be learned, because young children don't have any problem with the idea of dentures or poop or dead animals or all kinds of bodily fluids that as we get older we consider to be in the disgusting category. So it needs to be learned, and it seems to be unique to humans.
Mm-hmm. And it does seem very clearly, at least the beginning, if you ask this question, well, why should we have this, that it very clearly it has a protective function. And in fact, you make a really interesting distinction between and relationship between fear and disgust, how those two things are different, and how they both may have a function to keep us safe, but from two very different kinds of threats.
Right. So I have this idea. I don't know if it's true, but it seems to me to make some sense that the emotion of disgust evolved uniquely in humans out of the emotion of fear to warn us against threats to our life and survival that are not fast, like the tiger jumping on your head, which is fear, or the fire, you know, leaping out at you, which is also fear, but rather threats which are slow and where the prognosis is kind of uncertain. And specifically, those things have to do with disease. So, for example, if you start mucking around, you know, touching somebody's oozing sores, let's just say, and then a couple of weeks later you find out that you have oozing sores all over you and that person that you were touching, they're dead now, you have to be able to make the connection and have the understanding that there was some link between what they had and now your illness and your demise. And that takes a very complex brain, which is one of the other reasons why I think humans are the only ones to have it. And also is an issue for animals such as us that have extremely long lifespans. And that's why I'm interested in elephants, because they also have very long lifespans. Because we really have only one major predator, and that major predator is pathogens. So, and the fact that they're invisible means, and we usually can't smell them, we can't hear them and so forth, means we need to be able to be reactive to cues which indicate their presence. But we have to learn what those cues are. So it's pretty complicated.
Yeah. So, but it's fairly easy to understand that that even if human beings didn't know what the mechanism was, that after a while of trial and error, you might get to the point where you'd understand that that eating something that was decomposing or messing around with a body that was decomposing, that in the long run, this is not a good behavior. So that this was something that would have evolved so that we would have had this kind of mechanism that would say to us, okay, just stay away from that. And to have this ew thing, it's the way of saying, okay, just stay away from that.
Right. I think that rather than it having evolved fully, as you just described it, it's as though the mechanism is prepared to respond. So we need to learn what the cues are, what the signals, what the situations are, where we want to say ooh or yuck and move away. Because that's also one of the interesting things about disgust. Like fear, we want to get away from it. But the way that we get away isn't quite the same. We're not usually running at top speed away from somebody who looks sick. We rather want to make sure that we don't get close enough to them that we are in physical contact with them, that they may touch us or contaminate us. So we have to learn, and we have, I think, going into it, the prepared sense that this is something we're going to need to be aware of. But the actual sort of basics of it and what it's going to do and where it is and so on, that has to be learned by the environment that we're in and the culture that we're in, too.
And certainly that's one of the things, again, that's interesting about this, that the triggers for disgust are culturally bound, and from one place to another and maybe one person to another, they're going to be different.
Right. Like, for instance, take this little Starbucks scandal about the Beetlejuice sweetener.
Oh, right.
And how people are reacting to that and saying, you know, how it's disgusting and so forth. Well, there's countries all around the world that actually eat bugs as their primary source of protein in all kinds of food preparations. And this is desirable and nutritious, and all sorts of other good things are connected to the idea of eating beetles and locusts and crickets and worms and whatever else might be. But we in this culture have a very negative view of that. And we feel that this is an animal that we don't have to have anything to do with from the food consumption basis. But if we were taught differently about what is food, I mean, this is sort of an extreme example, but you see this all over the place. I mean, for instance, the differences between countries like in Asia that consider cheese to be disgusting and we consider cheese to be a delicacy or a comfort food. You know, these are radically different opinions about nutritional sources, and they are all based on what our culture tells us is acceptable or not.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Rachel Herz. She teaches at Brown University. She is an expert on the psychology of smell and emotion, and she's the author of the book That's Disgusting, Unraveling the Mysteries of Repulsion. That's the subtitle. It's published by Norton. Questions, welcome. Questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And people have done experiments with taste to try to figure out what it is that people were sort of predisposed to, and maybe people have seen the photographs of the results, so that you can take a baby, and if you drop a little drop of something really sweet on the baby's tongue, she will smile. She will look very happy. And if you drop a little drop of something really sour on her tongue, she'll make that ew face. And everybody knows what that is. You know, it's that picture that's on the front of the book of a woman making the ew face. And we could take that picture around the world and show it to people of different cultures in different places and say to them, okay, what's going on here? What's this person experiencing? They know what that is. And it seems to be at least initially linked to taste. And particularly when we taste something really sour or maybe something bitter, how much of this is starts out being about taste and maybe also about smell?
Well, actually, in terms of the taste reaction, it's really mainly about the bitter, because if you put a citric acid sour solution on an infant's tongue, you'll see the kind of pucker face, but you won't see that disgust grimace, that classical face that's the same as we make to something that's bitter or something that's emotionally disgusting. So the bitter response is actually because things that taste bitter generally are poisonous.
Right.
So we want to get them out of our mouth. Things that are acid, such as things that are sour, are not necessarily so bad. So sweets, carbohydrates, yum, bitter, poisons, yuck. So that's the basic mechanism there. Smell, actually, I think is very interesting, because this is one of the things that let me think about disgust, I think, in a deeper way, is that there's actually a lot of commonalities between the sense of smell and how we experience a smell as being good or bad and the way we perceive something as being disgusting or not, because so much of it has to do with context. You know, what's the situation that we're in when we experience whatever this trigger is, how we've been taught to respond to it, how we feel at that particular time, how culture makes such an amazing difference when it comes to our perceptions. So it's really, I think both disgust and smell are very similar in that they're highly, highly influenced by cultural and social and learning factors. But smells, believe it or not, are actually not inherently good or bad. We, in fact, have to learn that the smell of rose is good and the smell of skunk is bad. And if we don't get that lesson, we can end up with the opposite types of reactions, such as myself, who made the mistake as a young child confessing to like the smell of skunk on the playground. And I was made terrible fun of after that. But I didn't know it was supposed to be bad.
That's interesting. Well, I do, again, I think that this the ways that learning can shape this whole experience, I think, is very interesting. And I guess I think, going back to the thing about bitter, you know, as you say, that we seem to have this inborn disinclination to bitter things because out in nature, bitter things are often not safe. They're often poison. But then again, we learn to like bitter things. And I like coffee an awful lot, but that's an acquired taste because of that bitterness. And it just says something, I think, about how much of this has to do with learning what your experience is and, you know, how that changes with can change with repeated exposure.
Right. And you bring up an interesting point, too, about the context of food. So coffee, not sort of in the food category, but for example, hot pepper burn. You know, most people have a tolerance threshold for a certain degree of hot pepper burn above which it becomes severely unpleasant, you know, very painful and so forth. But then there are people who are like the habanero contest winners and so on, and they claim to be able to tolerate, you know, hugely mm-hmm. high levels of burn. What was interesting is that there was a study done where people were given the level of capsaicin, that's the ingredient that makes hot peppers hot, in a liquid solution out of the context of a pepper, out of the context of food, and they were asked to evaluate it. And they could nowhere near tolerate the level of burn that they could in a pepper in just plain old solution. Hmm. So the context of food and all our associations of food really go a long way in mediating our reactions to things. So eating something or the specific taste or the flavor of something out of the food medium is much, much less desirable than in the food medium. We love food, and food makes a very positive context for things which might otherwise not be so pleasant.
Well, certainly there are the place that you really start and the place it's easy to start to talk about disgust and the differences between people and places does have to do with food, because there are places where, well, you mentioned the fact that there are places where people eat insects, and it's a very common thing. And there are people who eat all kinds of stuff, things that would easily disgust us, but, you know, we weren't raised that way.
Exactly. So, for instance, in Iceland, you know, harkarl, which is this rotted, fermented shark meat that's literally – that's decomposed. It hasn't been cooked. It's literally just left to totally decompose, and then it's dried out, and this is what's consumed. Apparently has a really strong ammonia scent and flavor, sort of urinous and ammonia and all kinds of things that we would think of as being terrible, but it is considered delicious and a delicacy in that country. And as you said, I mean, even something as simple as cheese, where, you know, most of Western culture considers it to be one of the food staples and, you know, a delicacy, all kinds of good things associated to it. In Asia, cheese is literally, you know, the equivalent of cow excretions or rotted cow excretions. And that's because that's what it is, you know, rotted milk. mm-hmm. Because cheese is actually, you know, fermented and rotted. You look at blue cheese where molds are allowed to grow. I mean, if you thought, you know, you're eating mold right now, that might not seem so appealing. But if I said, would you like a piece of Stilton, you might say, sure.
Let's take a call here. We have somebody to talk with in Champaign. This is line number one.
Hi, David. Thanks for having your guest on today.
Sure.
Couple of things right quick. When we talk about the Starbucks and the Beatles, I believe that's cochineal extract that you're talking about. And that's in a lot of cosmetics and actually in a fair number of other foods. It's part of the reason that the FD&C red dyes were developed, because you have to collect these little beetles and
yeah, it's for coloring. So I think not for flavor, but I think because it makes things red.
Yeah. So, I mean, people have been eating that for a long time. It's actually sort of mentioned in the Mosaic dietary laws as something that's not allowed, forbidden. And then when we talk about Asians not liking cheese, actually part of the issue with that, too, is you need certain bacteria in your gut to process the cheese so that it doesn't make you sick. And a lot of Asian cultures don't have a lot of cow's milk, dairy in their diet. I mean, they do have some other milks like goats and camels, but they don't have cow's milk. And when you don't have those specific lactobacillus, it really messes with your stomach when you try to eat cheese. So that's part of where the stress comes from, is it's more of a biogenetic thing.
Okay, I don't know. Rachel, you want to comment on that at all?
Sure. Well, with respect to the lactose intolerance, that's actually, you know, cheese, because it's fermented, the lactose has been converted, the sugar has been converted, so that generally speaking, unless you're really severely lactose intolerant, people can consume cheese. One of the things I heard as a possible reason for why cheese, for example, doesn't exist in China or Japan is because it depended on getting rennet from the insides of sheep stomachs, mm-hmm. and that is because sheep were not indigenous originally to that part of the world, that the development of cheese sort of didn't come about from the point of view of the agriculture of the area, and then as a function of more cultural and social ideologies became considered to be something not good to eat. So that's where I would go with the cheese comment.
Okay.
But thank you.
All right. Well, I thank you for the question, the comment. Others are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Just, I am really fascinated. I guess I hadn't really thought about this very much, though, about how you go around the world and how many places the people have foods that are something that's fermented, which, as you say, maybe that's also another way of saying something that's rotted. And even in, I don't know if people are familiar with natto, mm-hmm. which is a fermented soybean that is some people in Japan like. I think probably actually some Japanese who don't like it particularly either. But I think for someone who had not experienced that before, they would say it was a pretty nasty thing. But, you know, again, it sort of depends on, it just sort of depends on what it is that you were brought up with.
Right. Well, natto is this stringy, slimy, fermented soybean dish, yeah. and it is a staple for breakfast in Japan. So there may be people who don't like it, but everyone Japanese that I know of and what I read, the amount of natto that's produced annually is staggeringly high. It's like beyond cornflakes. So in any case, that is something which as a cultural experience is just part of what is food. It's basically, this is classified as food. This is an experience which is food. And if you don't consider that to be food, and what I find to be the real stumbling block or stopping block when it comes to natto is the aroma. So, and the aroma of cheese is actually what tends to really put people off who haven't had the experience of learning that this is something yummy to eat. Because this is a very anecdotal self-description, but to me, natto smells like basically a tire fire. And not that a tire fire is the worst smell in the world, but it doesn't have any meaning associated with eating to me. So mm-hmm. again, it's how we learn what it is that food is and what it is that is delicious and what it is that's disgusting. And for the emotion of disgust, that applies to everything. I mean, one of the other really sort of fascinating self experiments we can do with disgust is think about the saliva that's in your mouth right now. It's probably no problem for you at all. Mm-hmm. Now, if I were to say, spit into a cup and now drink what's in that cup, you probably think, ugh. And it's your saliva. It was in your mouth 2 seconds ago. Yes. I'm not asking you to drink somebody else's saliva, nothing like that. And yet, there's this transformation that takes place psychologically when something leaves our body. And I think the idea comes from the contamination of the outside and protecting our insides from the outside. And that's a fundamental feature of the emotion of disgust. We're trying to protect ourselves from contamination, from pollution, from other sorts of things which could be dangerous, and particularly things to do with disease.
Yeah. And that's what really gets into this interesting territory, that this inside-outside thing that illustrates, that also works in the you and me thing, that the me and the other, which can then generalize to all sorts of things.
Right. So it can have, you know, very insidious and negative consequences, too, when I start castigating the other, a group of people, for example, as being disgusting, as equating them to vermin, as equating them to, you know, cancerous tumors and so on. And that becomes very contaminating and makes it very easy to really think about, you know, wanting to get rid of that group of people, exterminate that group of people, just like you'd want to exterminate vermin. So it's a very suggestible and very contagious way of thinking. But another thing that's really interesting about you know, the other, is it again depends on who that other is. I mean, for one, you know, parents, especially mothers, often say my baby's diaper smells okay or fine, but your baby's diaper smells disgusting. Mm-hmm. Or even more extreme, think about what's going on in sex, all that swapping of bodily fluids with another person. If we were to think about that in a context outside of sex, it would probably be gross, but it's your lover, it's in a highly specific situation, which is highly desirable, and it becomes erotic, it becomes exciting, it becomes amazing. So, you know, this is, again, how context, how thought, how perception influences what we think is disgusting or not.
Yeah. Well, this, and again, this goes to another level, and it's something that you talk about, is and why it is that we are troubled by human waste, by blood, by other body fluids, maybe by sexual behavior, is that what it does is it reminds us of our animal nature. And, you know, sometimes that's uncomfortable.
Well, exactly. So I think that the kernel at the heart of disgust is our fear of death. And the things that disgust us are things that remind us of our creatureliness, that remind us of the fact that we, just like cockroaches and rats and squirrels and lions and tigers, are going to die. And we haven't been able to solve that problem yet with all the trying that we may have. And this is an extremely uncomfortable thought. And for the most part, we deny, suppress, ignore that fact. People talk about death in this probabilistic term, you know, if whatever, you know, if I die. And the unfortunate thing is, it's not if, it's when. So the concept is very disturbing to us. And most of the time, we just put it out of our mind. But when things remind us of the fact that we could be squished, so when we see somebody maimed or deformed, this is a reminder of that. If we see someone behaving animalistically, like sticking their face into a bowl of soup and lapping it up, this is something animals do that reminds us, you know, we too are animals, animals die, and so on. So sexuality, again, you know, is probably one of the most animalistic things that we do without, and it doesn't get covered up, so to speak, you know, at least not when you get right down to it. And this, again, is disturbing because of its, you know, ultimate kind of rutting animalness. Mm. So it's, again, all connected to that.
So there, so you're sort of making the argument that we were talking earlier, for example, about maybe the reason that we experience this, we experience disgust when we see a dead body. It's partly because we have some, on some level, we understand that there's a possibility that we could acquire some sort of disease by having contact with it. So partly we're protecting ourselves by just by this thing that makes us not want to go near it. But on another level, you're sort of saying, well, and but also something that's involved, that's operating there, is when we look at that dead body, we think, you know, that could be us. And that's a pretty uncomfortable realization.
Exactly. And I actually think that the latter comment you make, that could be me, is more powerful. And I think that's what sort of, you know, feeds back onto the other sorts of things that might be contaminating. Because just seeing a dead body is not necessarily in and of itself contaminating. You need all kinds of signs of decomposition before you start thinking, well, there's, you know, oozing substances. And if that touched me, that could infect me and so on. So I think that the first idea is that could be me. And that's very unsettling. And I want to get away from that. So the idea of disgust is I want to move away. I reject that. I am getting away from that. And moral disgust is the same thing. I reject you for that behavior. I reject whatever it is you've done. And the concept of rejection, or the motivation of rejection, I think is the heart of all of this. And we reject death.
In this hour of the show, Rachel Herz is our guest. She teaches at Brown University. She's an expert on the psychology of smell and emotion. And she is the author of a recent book that's titled That's Disgusting, Unraveling the Mysteries of Repulsion. W.W. Norton is the publisher. And it takes a look at disgust, one of the six basic human emotions, but the only one apparently that is unique to humans. And one of the interesting things about it is it has to be learned. It is shaped by culture, and culture ends up guided by it. Well, having said all this about how there are certain things that disgust us, and they often have to do with bodies and death and blood and bodily fluids, well, that of course invites this question about, well, wait a minute. There are some times that we actually seek that out in popular entertainment. There are people who like to watch movies that other people might find disgusting. things of the gross monster nature, which can be very violent and can involve death and dismemberment and blood. And then the question is, well, why? How do we explain that? Why would anybody like that?
Yeah, well, that's a great topic. And I have a chapter in my book all about this lure of horror. And we are perversely attracted to disgust. That's one of the really fascinating things about it. So although, yes, disgust makes us want to move away from and get away from this, the trigger that's causing us to feel it, we're also perversely very interested and very curious and very intrigued by it. And we also often even get pleasure in indulging in it, depending upon your predilections. That could take all sorts of manifestations. But the one that's mainly commercially available is the horror movie or even the gross-out genre of sort of slapstick films like Animal House and so forth. But the reason that I think we're so interested in horror, there's a couple of reasons, actually. So the horror movie thing has to do with a couple of different factors. One has to do with the desire for thrills and spills, and this is called sensation-seeking. And it's something – it's like the high that you get from being in a terrorized state, sort of the same sort of idea of why you would want to ride a roller coaster. And people vary to the degree that they want to be in that state. And it also depends on your age, because everybody, even the most thrill-seeking person, when they get older, sort of after the age of mid-40s, starts to like that, you know, bumpy ride a little bit less. So the idea is that there's something going on physiologically from being an adolescent, which is when there's the most drive for this kind of experience, to when we get older, when it starts to wane. So there's that aspect. And people differ to the degree to which they love it when they're adolescents and young adults as well. Another thing I think that's playing into this is, again, our fascination with death. So although we're terrified of it, we're also extremely intrigued by it too. And it's this gigantic mystery. What will it be like? What is that experience going to be about? So when we see these sort of ridiculously terrifying and disgusting things on screen, it's kind of cathartic. It's like, well, it couldn't be that bad. So you get this kind of relief from the experience of anxiety you have about your own death, and also the anxieties you have in general life. Hitchcock said something great. He said, I aim to provide the public with beneficial thrills or beneficial shocks. So he was hoping that, you know, the idea of getting relief from normal daily stresses, from being terrorized in movies and so on. And then finally, there's this human predilection called benign masochism. And this is the idea that we actually like to put ourselves in, quote unquote, harm's way when we know it's not really harmful. So, for example, you know, eating those burning habanero peppers, we know we're not really doing any physical damage by eating them, as that there's this desire to sort of push to the limit, you know, riding the roller coaster, watching the horror movie, bungee jumping, those kinds of things. These are disgusting and terrifying experiences, which we like to do when we feel that they're actually safe. So that whole constellation of things goes together, I think, to make horror movies a big drive at the box office.
Hmm. If people, by the way, are curious about their tolerance for disgust or how they would rate on the disgust scale, there actually is a little quiz in the book that people can take where you ask people to respond to questions that involve disgusting things. It's so disgusting, I won't even read some of the questions. But if people are interested, you know, they could take the test, which leads me to a question about the range of people and their tolerance for disgust. Is there a real big difference from one person to the next?
Well, yes, it's an individual personality trait, just like, you know, the degree to which you are a party animal or prefer to, you know, spend your time reading by yourself quietly, and, you know, the degree to which you are anxious or not, and so on. And it's a relatively stable personality trait. So the degree to which you are disgustable right now is pretty much the same as it'll be 5-10 years from now. Although it is the case that as we get older, again, into the golden years, just like our drive for going to see horror movies declines, actually our reaction to disgust also declines. And there are various reasons, both biological and psychological, I think, that could be mediating that. But the range in terms of the disgust scale that's in the book, the average is about 40. And this is just from thousands of people who've taken the test, and that's the average score. So the average score seems to be in the low 40s. And the maximum score is 100. The minimum score is 0. So depending upon, you know, your degree of disgustableness, you can be anywhere in that range. What's interesting also is that there are people who are very low in disgust sensitivity. They could have certain neurological problems, actually a disorder called Huntington's chorea. One of the interesting and unfortunate things about this illness is that on top of the motor deterioration that occurs, there's also a lack of disgust perception. This is a very interesting thing about this particular disorder. But it's also the case that people who are psychopaths are very, very low in disgust. And this is what, in fact, separates them from other violent offenders. Generally speaking, violent offenders across the board don't have a lot of fear, and they're not very good at recognizing fear in others. But psychopaths are special in that they really do not experience disgust, and they can't tell when you're disgusted either. Hmm. So this makes them a very special group and potentially frightening if you know someone who scores, you know, a 5 on the disgust scale. Although I'm not, you know, identifying that as being anything diagnostic, yeah, but something to think about anyway.
Well, that I suppose that again gets back to this idea that that somehow disgust, it's something about it. It's a shared experience, and maybe I don't know if this has to do with learning disgust. It has to do with me understanding what makes another would lead another person to experience disgust, or when it is that they're experiencing disgust. It's a very shared kind of a thing.
Exactly. I think disgust is an extremely social emotion. Mm-hmm. It has a lot of social meaning. By looking at my face, you learn about what's going on in the environment. I could protect you from eating something and so on. And, you know, you think about psychopaths, it's sort of the quintessentially antisocial personality disorder. And so the fact that they don't experience disgust seems to fit right in with those ideas about the sociality of disgust.
Yeah. It's also kind of interesting that people who have obsessive compulsive disorder, which might lead people to be disgusted at everything, they're also pretty bad at recognizing disgust in other people.
Yeah, so this is something quite interesting. So people with OCD, as you just said, are basically disgusted at almost everything. I'm not going to touch the doorknob. You know, I might be contaminated. I mean, it depends on your subtype of obsessive compulsive disorder. But generally speaking, it's a ramping up of all things disgusting. And in fact, the neurocircuitry of OCD is very similar to the neurocircuitry of our emotional experience of disgust. But what's peculiar is that if I have OCD and I see you having to stick your hand in a bowl of worms or cold spaghetti that you're told is worms, and I look at your face, I really do not know what emotion you're experiencing. And this seems to be, again, something to do with the fact, or leading back to how important learning is when it comes to disgust. And that is the case that if I feel disgusted pretty much at everything, I look around the world around me to see how other people are responding to the same situation. So I go to, you know, not want to touch the doorknob, and I pull out a handkerchief and I look, and people are making all different sorts of facial expressions. They're not making the disgust facial expression. I may be making the disgust facial expression or feeling it, but I don't see that mapped onto other faces. So as a function of the fact that my experience of disgust doesn't get mapped onto my social environment in other people's experiences most of the time, means that I don't really know what it looks like when somebody else is disgusted.
About five, maybe more like 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Rachel Herz is our guest. She's on faculty at Brown University. She's the author of the book, That's Disgusting, Unraveling the Mysteries of Repulsion. It's published by W.W. Norton. And again, questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And you can send an email if you like. It's will-talk@illinois.edu. Now, one of the advantages that we have, people who study the brain and want to try to understand what's going on in the brain, we do now have these technologies that we can actually look in there and see what's going on when people are doing common tasks or experiencing various sorts of things, and we may be getting a little bit better idea about what's happening in the brain and how it functions. So having said all that, what when someone is experiencing disgust, I'm sure we could engineer such a thing, and then we could put them in a brain scanner and see what was going on. What goes on in the brain when someone is experiencing disgust?
Well, the main structure in the brain that's activated when we're experiencing disgust is called the anterior insula. It's the front part of the structure of the brain called the insula, which is like a little – actually, when people, when neuroanatomists first discovered it, they thought it was a separate lobe of the brain because it kind of looks like its own little lobe. But in fact, it's tucked in between several other lobes, the temporal, the frontal, and the occipital lobe. But in any case, the front part of it, the anterior insula, is where – it's what lights up very bright when we think about eating your sister's scab or looking at mutilation pictures or overflowing toilets and so forth. But the other interesting thing is it actually also lights up when we taste food. So this is also what's called the primary taste cortex, which again brings us back to the sort of fundamental connection between our experience of taste and the emotion of disgust. Mm. There are some other areas that are also activated, but the anterior insula is really home plate.
Okay. We have a caller in Urbana. Let's talk with them. Line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I was curious about this conversation. It's been very interesting. But did you look at our feelings of disgust with other people or situations that don't have to do with the taste buds or our noses? I'm talking particularly about personalities that clash, say, in a workspace or... You know, what I mean is, like, sometimes you can have a very physical reaction to someone that you just don't like being around that person because of their way of life, something they've said. I mean, I know that's probably also culturally learned, but maybe we're misusing the word because I think disgust, we use that word so often that I'm not sure if what I'm thinking about coincides with your sort of scientific and biological concepts of disgust.
Well, you bring up an excellent point, and in fact, it's a major controversy currently whether or not our experience of moral disgust, so when I feel that you've done something, you know, mistreated someone, whatever the case might be, said something which I consider really negative and inappropriate, and I say, that's disgusting, or I tell somebody else that I think that you're disgusting, and whether or not that's the same thing as what I feel when I'm told I have to hold your dirty dentures or something along those lines. And so this is a I know personally, I'm on the side of the camp, and this is a pretty big camp. It's, you know, big tanks on both sides. But I'm on the side of the camp that actually says, no, this is not the same as holding your dirty dentures. This is really a metaphorical expression about my outrage, my anger, my indignation, my, yes, I'm rejecting you. I reject you for what you've done. But it's not the same visceral sensation as I feel if I have to, you know, touch earthworms or do something else which is in the more visceral category or be exposed to something that's in the more visceral category of disgust. But that's an excellent question.
Okay.
And we do, it's absolutely true, use that language. We use disgust to say, I think most of the time what we're really saying is, I am outraged, I'm angry at you, I reject what you've done.
Right. Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Well, I think, though, isn't it also true that there's a way that we may start with the idea that something is dirty, is foul, it's unclean, and that we are concerned about it because it's potentially, say, a vector of disease. But then we do talk about people or things being ritually unclean. Isn't that and so you could then end up feeling, say, disgust for a person. And it would seem like it's an extension of the same thing.
Well, that is, you know, a very interesting point, the idea of purity and versus uncleanliness in a spiritual sense, and, you know, the way religious doctrine also sort of works around that and identifies individuals who are unclean or polluted and how you don't want to be contaminated by them, as well as the religious and spiritual rituals about cleaning one's body, cleaning one's hands before prayer, doing other sorts of cleansing before God behaviors. And so there's definitely a psychological and a metaphysical connection between disgust and the rejection of other people as being impure and so on. But again, although it can be metaphorically similar, I don't think it's experientially the same sort of idea, except for, and this is something that the last caller I was going to say in connection to this, and this is something I think is quite fascinating, we can in fact condition a visceral physical response of being grossed out in ourselves by using that language. We can, in fact, turn on the nauseousness centers by saying, that's disgusting, that's gross that that person did that, because the words themselves are associated to our primary state with that emotion, which is visceral disgust. And by using them, we can actually turn on the emotion itself in that visceral context. Whereas if instead we'd said, I'm outraged by you, I reject what you've done, you know, go away from me, whatever the case might be, then we would not have that same physical feeling. So this is a very interesting idea that, in fact, we can make ourselves feel physically disgusted. It's something that inherently is not physically disgusting just by the language we use to describe it.
Mm, well, that also would suggest that makes a person a target for manipulation if you know that.
Absolutely. And again, what I was saying earlier on, how when a group is castigated and when certain kinds of language is used, like calling a group of people cancerous tumors or calling a group of people cockroaches, and the idea here is that we need to exterminate these people, we need to get rid of these people, and these people literally become infected by this language, and it really becomes easy for people, even totally rational, sensible, you know, good people, seeing this other group as being something disgusting. And it's very dangerous and very easy to manipulate.
Let's talk with someone in Champaign. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I want to broaden this a little bit as well. Is the perception of good and bad music, that is pretty and ugly music, good and bad colors, beautiful and ugly, are they triggering the same place in the mind? Is that the same sort of thing as disgust?
Well, that's a great question. I actually have to say I do not know the answer to that. I am not sure whether, again, it depends on if you're talking about an aesthetic experience that's intellectualized versus one that's really more of a visceral or a sensory experience. So unfortunately, I'm not the expert to be able to answer that, but it's a great question. And certainly the idea of ugliness, you know, especially when it applies to other people, is something that can conjure the feelings of visceral disgust. And again, the ugliness usually has to do with our ideas about deformity. You know, that person's deformed, they're ugly, they don't fit this prototype of what I think you should look like to be a person of, you know, this age and so on. Or even old age we often consider ugly, again, because of maybe it's reminders of our death and so forth. And then when we say other people are ugly by their behavior, this is this moral disgust that sometimes creeps in too. But your aesthetic question is great, and unfortunately I don't have the answer to that.
You suppose it triggers the same place in the brain, or is it a totally different operation? What would be your guess?
I don't think it's the same place. And the anterior insula, as far as I know, does not have much to do with artistic appreciation, so music or art. It does have to do, for example, with experiences of empathy, with experiences of pain, with experiences of addiction, with experiences of lust. So it has more, I think, more primitive reactions geared into it, or I like to call it what I think Freud would have dubbed it, the id. You know, it's all about these sort of impulses, whereas I think that the aesthetic reaction of this music is unpleasant to me is something different. But again, I really just don't quite know.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. I don't know if this is something that you can comment on. It came in by email. If you have anything you could say about a recent book on disgust that was written by a philosopher named Colin McGinn. Are you familiar with him?
I am not, I'm afraid to say. I do not know that book.
All right. Well, in that case, I'm sorry to the person who was writing in the question. We cannot respond. Let me ask you something different, because one of my colleagues this morning in the run-up to the show asked me something about whether women had a higher, let us say, higher threshold for disgust than men. That is, are they more tolerant, I guess, or does it take more to disgust them? And I said, well, I don't know. Are there any stable or obvious differences between genders when it comes to disgust?
Yes, and it's actually the opposite to what you said. So women are more disgust sensitive. They have a lower threshold to disgust than men do, generally speaking, across the board. But interestingly, the area of disgust that they're especially more disgustable compared to men is in sexual disgusts. So things to do with sexuality, for example, you know, you often hear women saying pornography is, women will more often say pornography is disgusting than men, and all kinds of other sort of deviations, big and small, in sexuality are generally speaking more disgusting to women than for men. And the reason for this, I mean, again, going back to biology, women have to be more careful about the environment they're in for reproductive purposes because of the fact that they are the one who's getting pregnant, gestating, and primarily taking care of a newborn. Their health, and also potentially more importantly, the health of that newborn or the health of that fetus, is critical from the point of view of, you know, the ongoing species and so on. And so being very cautious about the environment, being more disgustable, it makes sense there. And also not wanting to engage in sexual behaviors that could be dangerous, that could lead to increased vulnerabilities of a variety of kinds that could put herself or her infant or her fetus at risk. So this is one of the reasons why in the sexual domain, women seem to be especially sensitive.
Hmm. Just as a way of finishing up, way back at the beginning of the conversation, I noted that because you were an expert on the psychology of smell, that you had been invited to be a judge at a stinky sneaker contest, the National Stinky Sneaker Contest, and that you had done it, and other people had reacted to that when they learned that you were doing it. They said, ew, that's disgusting, and then that started you thinking about this whole business of disgust. Well, you also said that actually not only did you do it once, you'd gone back and done it more than once, which maybe invites a question about whether, as a result of your having spent time thinking about this and maybe experienced some disgusting things, I mean, did you find that your tolerance for or the way you think about disgust changed as a result of going through all of this?
Well, that's a great question. And just quickly, the one thing is that the more we're exposed to disgusting triggers, the less disgusted we become by it. The idea is basically everything, when it gets too familiar, just gets a bit boring. So this is why hospital workers can tolerate their jobs and so forth. But it generally stays restricted to the domain that they're exposed to. So if you keep being exposed to people being brought in on stretchers or having, you know, seeing car accidents and so forth, you may become less disgust sensitive to disfigurement, disbodiment, so on, but you're still going to be, let's say, as disgust sensitive to something else. However, the question you asked me about myself, this is interesting. I believed that I had become less disgust sensitive as a function of working on the book, writing the book, doing the contest, all sorts of things. And I recently re-gave myself that test that's in my book, mm-hmm. and I scored just as high as I did several years ago. And so I guess I've tricked myself. I think, you know, the certain things that I especially talk about, you know, I'm okay with that. But when it comes down to it, I'm just as disgust sensitive as I ever was. And right. I'm actually pretty disgust sensitive,
okay.
believe it or not.
Well, there we'll have to stop. The book is That's Disgusting, Unraveling the Mysteries of Repulsion by W.W. Norton, published by Norton, and by our guest, Rachel Herz. She teaches at Brown University. And we also want to say thanks to John Mazza. He's the technical director there at the other end of our connection. And to you, Professor Herz, thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, David. It was great to be on your show.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local production, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, breathing life into the history of our nation's musical past through exhibits, guided tours, and performances at the University of Illinois. More information is available and visits can be scheduled at 217-244-9309.
On tomorrow's Focus, we'll be live in the 10 o'clock hour with a conversation about farmers markets. We'll talk with Janine McLaughlin, food writer, blogger, and founder of the Rustic Kitchen Cooking School. She's also the author of Farmers Markets of the Heartland. She went around touring farmers markets throughout the Midwest, including Market at the Square here in Urbana. That'll be our other guest, Lisa Brault, Economic Development Specialist Director from Urbana's Market at the Square. They'll both be here to talk about some of the potential benefits of visiting farmers markets, and we'll talk about why it is there aren't that many people that actually go. When you look at the overall population, it's really not a significant percentage. Why is that? We'll explore it. In the 11 o'clock hour of the program, we'll listen to a rebroadcast from April of this year with James Barrett, a professor of history at the University of Illinois. He talks about America's first ethnic group, its first immigrants, the Irish. As such, they laid the foundation for the immigrants who followed, and that foundation was at once hostile and welcoming. Barrett says in the end it led to a new sense of American identity that continues to influence today. We'll talk about his book, The Irish Way: Becoming American in the Multi-Ethnic City. That's in the 11 o'clock hour tomorrow.
Let's update you now on the commodity markets. The latest tick, Kansas City wheat for September is trading at 900 and a quarter, up 15 and three quarters. December wheat at 918 and a quarter, up 15 and one quarter. Chicago wheat for September is trading at 894 and a half, up 10. December wheat at 907 and a half, up nine and three quarters. September corn's at 788, up 11 and a quarter. December corn at 781, up 8 and a half. August soybeans trading at 1641, up 7 and a quarter. September beans at 1613 and a quarter, up 3 and 3 quarters. August soybean meal trading at 493.10, up 580. September soybean meal at 482.20, up 380. August soybean oil's at 54.35, that's down 30 cents on the day. September soybean oil at 54.55, down 32 cents. August live cattle trading at 115.90, down 90. October live cattle at 120.15, down 40. August feeder cattle at 133.52.5, down 247.5. September feeder cattle at 136.20, down 295. August lean hogs at 90.05, down 37.5 cents. October lean hogs at 77.67.